ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Anne Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. I've spent a fair bit of time in hairdressers and beauty salons over the years, and one of the great joys of the hour or so I spend in these places is having a yarn with the beauty therapist, emphasis on the word therapist. I'm not a big one for spilling my secrets to a relative stranger, but some of the things I've overheard other people in the salon share, it can get heavy. There's been research into better equipping the people who become our de facto therapists, the beauticians, hairdressers, nail techs, to give them the tools to respond to what we tell them. Plus, if you've got the hump day blues, you'll want to hear Lisa Leong's tips on how to quit. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. How did you sleep last night? I hope it was great, but if it wasn't, it makes a lot of sense. There are so many things that can disrupt a good night's rest: stress, kids, screen time, a crappy mattress, a snoring partner. But is there a chance that we're just collectively kind of bad at it? It turns out that among our ape relatives, us humans barely sleep at all. And you're about to meet an evolutionary biologist who wants you to rethink modern sleep, not as something we're not getting enough of, but as something of an evolutionary advantage. David Sampson is an associate professor at the University of Toronto in Canada. He's written a book about the way our sleep has evolved all the way from our early primate ancestors to us here in the present day. It's called The Sleepless Ape, The Story of Sleep in Human Evolution. David, welcome to Life Matters.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Tegan.
David, how did you sleep last night?
Actually, with a 2.5-year-old and a 3-month-old and my wife and I were on the road, we didn't sleep too bad at all.
Okay. That is not what you usually hear from a new parent.
It's actually not. We picked up a few tricks from the Hadza. They're one of the last foragers on the planet. And they are habitual breast sleepers. And so I'm just an evolutionary anthropologist. Talk to your clinician about breast sleeping and co-sleeping with an infant. But ever since we adopted this strategy with our firstborn after 6 months of struggle, it ended up really helping. So the breast sleeping and the co-sleeping has been one of the strategies we've used to sort of look at how people in a more natural environment sleep and co-sleep and try and help improve our sleep in the global north.
I will say official Australian guidelines do state that the safest place for a baby to sleep is in their own cot or bassinet in the same room as their parents. How does that fit?
That's not unlike the recommendations in North America as well.
Okay, so disclaimer. I do, however, love that you apply this evolutionary understanding of sleep to help you get through the newborn phase. You mentioned the Hadza people before. They're one of the last hunter-gatherer societies in the world living in Tanzania. For this book, you embedded with them to understand how people in these societies sleep. Can you tell me about the Hadza?
Yeah. So they're one of the last foragers on the planet. They still hunt and they still gather for most of their calories, meaning the men typically go out and they'll hunt with poison-tipped arrows. And typically the women will be responsible for keeping the camp safe. And I spent an entire summer out there in Hadza land with me and a researcher who could speak a much better Swahili than my broken field Swahili.
So what stage of your career were you when you went out there? Like how much unpicking were you doing of your preconceptions in this trip?
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, the topic of my research being sleep. And if you'd asked me 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if I would become a specialist on the evolution of sleep, I would have laughed. But during my postdoc, I came across some really fascinating work First of all, there's just a dearth of understanding of sleep in the natural world, how humans sleep when we're free ranging and wild. Nobody had really done that research because actigraphy hadn't become, that's like these super sciencey Fitbits, that it hadn't become really widespread in the scientific community until about 2014, 2015, when I had just gotten my PhD and I had just started my postdoc at Duke University, which I started really getting interested in this topic of sleep because of this massive paradox. And Tegan, you actually opened up saying we're kind of bad at sleep as a species, but I want to reverse that logic on its head. We're so good at it, and we've come up with so many clever ways to protect our sleep environments, especially uniquely so socially in our species, that we can do less of it. We can get higher quality versions of it. And I call this the sleep paradox. And once I grappled my head around the uniqueness of this paradox, I was obsessed because there's nothing like a paradox, scientific paradox, to get you hungry to try and understand the natural world.
Okay, so why does it feel like I have such a bad night's sleep? If I'm so good at it and we've evolved so many great ways and we're really, really good at it, David, why does it feel like I slept terribly sometimes?
Well, you know, so there's a couple different ways to slice the pie here. So yes, you might subjectively feel like you had a poor night's sleep, but compared to what? Is the question. And so if we were to actually, then this is a paper that myself and my now postdoc, it was a PhD student of mine, Leela McKinnon, we published in Proceedings B last year. And we wanted to look at small scale foragers, and we wanted to look at on the grid post-industrial society. So like off grid versus on grid, small scale versus large scale. Tegan, you and me, we classify as large scale post-industrial, right? Mm-hmm. And we have this sort of like this, oh, it's so awkward, our relationship with sleep in the post-industrial world. We're kind of terrified about it. Yet the science shows we sleep longer on average 7.1 versus the 6.4 in the small scale. And in fact, when we look at sleep quality, we're getting 88% of the time that we're in bed, we're asleep. This is compared to 74 if you're small scale. And the National Sleep Foundation recommends 85 or above for healthy sleep. So 7.1 in terms of sleep duration, that's 45 more minutes a day of sleep than sleeping in a small scale society. And my claim here is that we were probably doing this more or less in the Paleolithic for the past 1.5 million years, because these are the kinds of societies that our ancestors evolved in. So I really think it's sort of this problematization of sleep and the way we're framing our sleep that makes us so stressed out. So, for example, a Hadza forager doesn't have to wake up at early in the morning and say, talk to a sleep scientist that's, I don't know, 8 a.m., right? That's not a concern a Hadza hunter-gatherer has. They go out and they hunt when they want to and they forage when they want to. So there's this also this, it's our relationship with sleep that might make you feel a little bit of trepidation that many of us feel.
So what, if I have a bad night's sleep, it's all in my head?
It's not all in your head, but I guess we need to look at this from an evolutionary standpoint. There are some things worth losing your sleep over. And I call this the paleo sleep gear. Yes, there is optimum sleep. You can sleep like a Benedictine monk day in, day out. And if you safeguard your sleep start time, you safeguard your sleep exit time, and you sleep in this, you know, hermetically sealed box that has no stimulus, and you do this routinely and you channel this with your metabolic regulation, and you don't eat 3 hours before bed, and you get lots of sunlight, and you do this day in, day out, you will sleep longer, and you'll probably live like 4 or 5 hours longer, 4 or 5 years longer in your life. But evolution doesn't care if you live a long time. Evolution cares that you survive and reproduce. What are some really good things to lose sleep over? Evolution says it's probably pretty good if you stay up to safeguard your children, to shore up alliances or find a mate, to protect your entire camp if need be from assault from a rival group or some sort of predator. These are all things that evolution has hard-coded and baked in us. And instead of looking at these things as like, you know, calling them dirty words like insomnia, we could look at it from the evolutionary standpoint and say, hey, this is like hypervigilance and probably quite adaptive in the Paleolithic.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. The voice you're hearing is that of David Sampson. He's an associate professor at the University of Toronto in Canada. He's the author of The Sleepless Ape, The Story of Sleep in Human Evolution. And he's out here just exploding our brains about how we think about sleep in modern societies. He's actually been out studying sleep in what he calls natural societies, hunter-gatherer societies in Africa, one particular hunter-gatherer society in Africa. David, to wind the clock back a little bit more, how important was sleep to human evolution? How do humans sleep compared to our relatives in the evolutionary tree?
Yeah, okay, so we got to look at this from the perspective of a primatologist. So let's talk about this from the primate order. And this is the crux of the sleep paradox. So we know, you were just hinting at this, Tegan, that you feel like crap when you don't get a good night's sleep. It probably affects your cognition. It might affect the way you can think and predict about long third, fourth, fifth order effects. It can affect your ability to socially regulate your emotions. It can affect your immune system. It can affect your resistance to injury. All these super crucial things. Yet we sleep the least of any primate ever recorded on the planet. We sleep on average around, if you look at all humans on the planet, every society clumped together, about 6 hours and 57 minutes per night. And to put this in perspective, the reigning champion sleeper in the primate order is the owl monkey. And do you know how long the owl monkey sleeps?
No, I don't think I've ever heard of an owl monkey. Okay, I'm going to go long. I'm going to say 18 hours a day.
That's it. Actually, like 17 and a half hours. I will round up and I'll give you the A on that.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And you think about it, we're like, oh my God, if only I could do more with my day, right? If only I could sleep less and do more. We've already min-maxed this thing. Most primates on average sleep way longer than humans. Great apes sleep about 10 to 11 hours, and they're our closest phylogenetically related cousins on the primate tree. So human sleep is totally weird.
Actually, it's funny that you say the word weird there, because weird, obviously strange, but also an acronym that you use in your book to describe the sorts of societies that you and I live in and maybe have skewed the way we look at sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. So this is a scientist by the name of Heinrich came up with this acronym, and it's really stuck because a lot of science, especially in the 20th century, was done in a lab or it was done in a Western context, mostly college kids in universities. And it's really been the charge of anthropologists everywhere, especially empirically grounded anthropologists, to try and get out into the field where people live a little bit more, I would say, more connected lives to their natural environment.
What does that mean for how we understand sleep?
Yeah. So, for example, the sleep itself is broken into two different major, what we call sleep architecture. So there's non-REM. And when you fall into sleep, you go into N1 and N2. This is when, if I were to say your name, Tegan, maybe like I could whisper it like this, Tegan, and you might wake up. Like your vigilance and your arousal threshold is very low. And then you go into what's called slow wave sleep. Here's where you get a really big boost to your immune system, especially if you're fighting something off. This is your restoration phase. And then you can go into REM, and there's a part of REM that is even deeper. It's called phasic sleep. And if I were to say your name, Tegan, you might not wake up. Mm-hmm. It is that the arousal threshold is that deep. And so what is fascinating about our sleep relative to all the other primates is that not only are we the shortest sleeper out of all the primates on the planet, but we have the most proportion of REM jam-packed in. And here's the mystery, because like how did that happen? And it turns out, if we look at this using sophisticated phylogenetic models, we see that we actually cut out that non-REM and we kept the REM. We protected it through 2 million years of human evolution. And what do we do with REM? It's like our nighttime therapist. It does our emotional regulation for us. And it also shores up our creativity and innovation with REM threat priming through dreaming. And so this is the kind of stuff that was super critical early on in human evolution. And the wild thing is, the way we got away doing this is exactly counter to what we think of today as optimal sleep environments. It's because we slept socially in groups that were protected by the group itself that we were allowed to go into these really special deep sleep architectures that allowed us to shorten our total sleep overall.
So because we knew we were safe, we could afford to go into this really, really deep extra restorative sleep.
That's a wonderful way of putting it.
So there's a lot of talk these days about optimizing sleep, but it sounds like we're kind of already doing that for ourselves. Is there any point trying to track or optimize your sleep?
Yeah, so I love optimizing my sleep, but I do it in kind of, I play a little meta strategy game about it because it takes concerted effort and some consistency to be able to do it. So you need to be kind of like pot committed. It's not something you can just be like, oh, tonight I'm going to have optimized sleep. You need to have an enhanced circadian rhythm. So you need to be getting your circadian cues from the light outside, from temperature outside, and you do need to be doing it, anchoring it in the morning light. And you need to be very mindful of the kind of light that you have in your environment at home after sunset. You want to avoid that nasty blue wave light that inhibits melatonin production, which is the principal hormone that regulates sleep-wake activity. So you want to be mindful of that, but it takes about 10 days or so to really crank it up. So the way I think about optimizing my sleep isn't necessarily like I'm going to get the perfect night's sleep every night. In fact, that's I'm a dad of two very young kids. It's totally not practical at all. But I'll give you an example of how I use these two different gears, the paleo gear of sleep and the optimal gear of sleep. So when I was writing The Sleepless Ape, I've been intimately connected and tied and into the science of enhancing one's circadian rhythm and enhancing sleep optimization for about half a decade now. So what I did, I made a deal with my wife. I was like, Nancy, can I take 3 months? I know you're pregnant right now. Can I take 3 months and basically turn on the optimal sleep gear? Meaning I'm going to be waking up exactly the same time every day. I'm going to have a Benedictine monk like religious schedule to my day. But what that will do is it will allow me to predictably unleash the best versions of my cognition at my sweet spot for writing. And what I predict is that I'll be able to write this book way faster so that when our firstborn is born, I will be able to turn on the paleo gear, meaning you can lean into all the other things that are more important than getting sleep that night. Be it shoring up, you know, like going out with your friends, which I do after going deep into the optimal sleep gear. You know, you can just switch this gear back and forth strategically if you know how to cue your system.
Pregnant women love it when their husbands take on a project during pregnancy. I can speak from experience.
Yes.
Talk a bit more about this paleo sleep. It sounds like that's our sort of natural state, but it's not necessarily what we should be aiming for these days.
Yeah. So to do it, basically, first of all, take a step back, take a deep breath. If you miss a little sleep, it's okay. We have a built-in homeostatic drive, okay? It is there to enhance our sleep long-term. It's when you feel when you feel that ATP well up and you feel all the toxins in your body and the spent proteins, that is your homeostatic drive telling you it's time to go to sleep. And that is the thing that will ultimately demand for you to go to sleep when you need to. So one thing to keep in mind, though, when you're doing this paleo sleep gear is to try and keep the overall architecture of the timing of your sleep. If you can still keep it somewhat consistent, it'll allow you to switch back from the optimal gear to the paleo gear with somewhat better ease.
So what do you want the modern humans listening to take away from this book you've written, David?
Yeah, it's to truly appreciate our sleep and how important it was in the evolutionary story, and to appreciate actually the uniqueness of it. So as humans, we're a pretty weird species on multiple fronts. So we don't have any, you know, large claws or big canines, yet we're the most dominant predator on the planet. we, by way of tool use, have been able to survive in every ecological niche on the globe. And what I want the listeners to kind of be excited about is that not only do we have all these other really weird traits, but sleep may be one of the weirdest, and it underpins all these things. It underpins our ability to think, our ability to survive and adapt. And it's part of this magical evolutionary puzzle that is, that has led to human life today.
David, thank you so much for joining me. David Sampson, Associate Professor at the University of Toronto in Canada. He's the author of The Sleepless Ape, The Story of Sleep in Human Evolution. It's out in Australia on 1st of September. Coming up next, there are things I've told my hairdresser that I hope she takes to her grave. In fact, let me just quickly Google if patient confidentiality extends to the beauty professions. I'll let you know how I go after the break.
Next week, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
Flowers don't usually inspire fierce competition.
Unless you're asking Australians to pick their favourites.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Vote now for Australia's favourite at abc.net.au/science.
Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National and at abc.net.au/science.
If I tally up the number of hours I've spent in hairdressers and beauty salons over the years, actually the idea of putting a number on just how much time I've spent there is a bit scary, but suffice to say, it's a lot. And we could talk about how women are generally held to a certain standard when it comes to how we look or how society funnels us towards spending more money on it. But I've got to say, I kind of love a salon moment. It's an hour or so or more for me. To flip through a magazine, maybe, but mostly to have a yak to a caring, listening ear, or sometimes maybe more accurately, a captive audience. I'm not telling my hairdresser anything too juicy, but I've overheard things from other people in the salon. It can get really heavy, kind of out of nowhere. And when the scissors and the shampoo and the blow dryers are packed away at the end of the day, those salon workers are left holding all our messy baggage with no training on what to do with it. There's been new research that's outlined the need to better equip the people who become our de facto therapists, the beauticians, hairdressers, nail techs, to give them the tools to respond to what we tell them, which I'm about to give you a bit more detail on in just a tick. But I also want to give you the chance to give your hairdresser or barber a shout out today. Who is the beauty professional who really helped you through a rough patch? What is it about that barber or hairdresser that makes you feel comfortable enough to potentially overshare a little bit? With me here is Stacey Page, a former hairdresser, now psychology researcher. Stacey, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning.
So hairdressing was your very first career. How old were you when you started out?
I was 14 when I started my apprenticeship.
Okay, so this is young. What kind of training were you getting at that age?
So generally when you're an apprentice, you go to trade school for once a week and then the rest is on the job training, so you'd be at work with clients.
What
they don't,
yeah, keep going.
Sorry. Yeah, they don't train us on how to communicate with our clients. It's, you're kind of thrown in the deep end, and people will tell you everything, secrets of all sorts.
Was this like from the get go, or was it when you got a bit older that people started sharing very personal stuff with you?
As I got older, it was sort of more in depth because I had my own clients. At the beginning, when you start your apprenticeship, you're kind of the shampoo girl, so you're washing people's hair, and a lot can come out at the shampoo station.
What kind of things?
I think because you're touching someone, it almost makes them feel like they can either touch you or talk to you about private things, because I kind of feel like the boundaries of, you know, are kind of murky because of that physical contact. So, you know, at the shampoo bowl, some people take it as like a sexual advance almost, and they'll make, you know, sexual comments to you about it. Or, you know, someone might be very stressed and then all of a sudden open up and talk about, you know, oh, my husband was really violent with me today or something like that. You know, it just kind of comes out. They almost just sort of forget that they're talking to a young person or whoever it is, they just open up and spill what's on their mind.
That must have been so confronting as a teenager for you.
It really was, yeah. So, you know, I had clients tell me that their children had just died, and I'd, you know, burst into tears, not being able to sort of cope with that information. Or, you know, so I had someone come in and tell me that their doctor just told them to get their affairs in order, and I didn't know what that meant. So I said, oh, that's nice. It's good to be organized. And it wasn't until they left that my boss came up to me and said, do you have any idea what they just said to you? You didn't handle that very well. And I felt terrible, you know, and that was, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and I still have held that with me.
Yeah, I can imagine that's the sort of thing that plays over in your head at 2 o'clock in the morning, Stacey. I'm just thinking about your boss coming up and telling you that that was inappropriate, but it doesn't sound like you ever had any kind of training or guidance on how to deal with a situation like that.
None at all. You know, there's no options to kind of debrief even with the with a staff member after and say, someone's just told me this and I'm feeling overwhelmed. You know, you're just sort of thrown in, like, we're in TAFE. They teach you how to do the technical side of things. They don't sort of tell you about how to interact with clients. They tell you not to talk about sex, politics or religion. But if a client brings it up to you, you kind of, you know, you just have to go with what the client says. You're told the client's always right. So, you know, you just have to lean into what they're talking about.
So, Stacey, part of the reason we're chatting to you today is because of your background in hairdressing, but a big part is because you've co-authored this new research into it, which we'll get into in a moment. But I'm wondering how much this emotional toll fed into your decision to leave the profession.
It fed a lot into it. I didn't understand people. That's why I went to do a psychology degree, because I just wanted to understand how to interact with people better. I realised that I was burnt out and I didn't understand why. And when I started to focus my research on that area, it all made sense. And a lot of people are leaving the industry because they don't know how to cope. They're very young. You know, when you're at TAFE, you're between the ages of 15 and 18. And there's not a lot of life experience to kind of guide you in even how to have those kind of conversations, let alone a proper course that teaches you how to respond in a way that protects both you and the client.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Stacey Page. She started out as a hairdresser at age 14, is now a PhD candidate at the Adelaide University, doing a study into the impact of emotional labour on salon workers. You're about to hear a little bit more about that study, but I'd also love to hear from you about what you think it might be that causes you to open up a bit if you're at the salon, if this is something you've done before, or if you are a salon worker, a barber, a hairdresser, a nail technician. What kind of things have people told you and how have you dealt with that? One person says, my hairdresser sobbed during my last cut as she told me about her recent breakup with her boyfriend, reverse therapy. Another person says, this is good advice. You should never share secrets with a third party because you may disclose facts which, if they were repeated, as an example, you could nevertheless identify the person of whom you speak. Well, also here with me is Dr. Hannah McCann, Stacey's co-author on this new paper. Hannah's at the University of Melbourne. Hannah, what kind of impact did the workers in the beauty professions describe having from this phenomenon where what Stacey's talking about, this oversharing in the salon chair?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And it's so great to have Stacey here too. Hi, Stacey.
Hi.
I think the thing is that over the many years that we've been working on these actually separate projects, but we've brought our research together because we have, you know, we're finding the same thing over and over. That everything that happens in life comes into the salon, is expressed in the chair. So that can be wonderful things. That can be, you know, marriages and relationship highs and birth of children and wonderful, lovely things, the texture of everyday life. But at the same time, it's also all of the really difficult things. It's terminal illness, it's breakups, it's affairs. I talked to multiple salon workers who were the first one to hear about someone's pregnancy loss before the intimate partner had even heard about the pregnancy loss. And so really carrying a lot for people emotionally and then immediately having to switch between clients. So, you know, just having to pull yourself together. No training at the fundamental level for, you know, the fact that you're even going to experience this in the salon. All of the qualifications at the certificate level are about technical skills. So, you know, you're not prepared for what is the reality of salon work. And then there's no, I mean, most salons don't really have a setup for debriefing or any other ways to support staff. So people are entering this industry extremely young with very little support. And there's also, I mean, a large part of our research is trying to change the kind of cultural conversation around this to recognize that it is complex social work that's going on here, that it is care work, and it's care for bodies, it's care for emotions, and it's care for people's identities as well. I mean, lots of things around gender expression and sexuality as well in the salon. So, you know, it's a very complex thing that isn't well supported in the industry at the moment and that urgently needs to be addressed.
What kind of training do you think would be useful?
Yeah, so what we're proposing is well-being training that's a core compulsory course for everyone in hair and beauty who is undergoing, you know, their first kind of training in hair and beauty. And that's really our focus is about hair and beauty workers being able to look after their own well-being. So not actually saying, here's some training so that you can be an actual kind of therapist at all. Nothing like that, of course, recognizing that that is not appropriate. But, you know, how can you refer people onto the appropriate services? How can you connect with local services like domestic violence services, mental health services, and so on, so that you as a worker do not feel like that is your burden to carry and that you can maintain professional boundaries, that you can set up debriefing mechanisms within salons, and, you know, so that you can deal with those workplace stresses in a way that avoids burnout and dropping out of the industry.
You are telling me some wild stories on the text line. One says, my hairdresser told me about a client who disclosed to her that she was poisoning her husband in a mutually abusive relationship. This was a lot for my hairdresser to carry, including fears she was now an accessory to crime. Fortunately, that client moved away, but it left a lasting emotional scar on my hairdresser. Hannah, that is hectic.
You know, it's not this is not even the first story I've heard about like a murder, essentially, from a hairdresser. So, they're hearing absolutely everything. And every single time I interviewed someone, they would tell me a crazier thing that someone told them. And I honestly can't repeat them on the radio.
Stacey, were you surprised by the sorts of stories that came out in the research? Or were you like, yeah, that sounds about right?
I wasn't surprised at all. I was just like, I've got some more stories I could add to it. Yep. Some of the things are full on, like Hannah said, you don't even want to repeat them because you think, oh my God, like, am I now in an accessory to this?
Yeah.
You know, I know too much information and I'm not a mandatory reporter. So what do I do with this information?
That's a really interesting kind of thing to bring up, that idea of who's a mandatory reporter, because that's kind of what you're saying, isn't it, Hannah, that this it's beauty therapy. It's these people are care workers.
Exactly. I mean, it's not like in a school or a social worker, right, where you're encountering disclosures about abuse and you have reporting duties. That's not the case in the hair and beauty industry. The question for hair and beauty workers is, what is confidentiality in the salon? What do I do with this information? How do I keep myself safe as well as respond to this appropriately? So you can see, like, these are urgent questions that need to be addressed. And if they're not happening, it makes it unsafe for everybody. I mean, there's a real opportunity here to have, you know, to be making a community difference. And this is something that actually quite a lot of domestic violence services around the world have increasingly recognized and have started running their own programs for reaching out to salons and training salon workers in how to recognize and respond to domestic violence and other signs of abuse. But one of the issues with those programs is, you know, A, it's just very much specifically focused on domestic and intimate partner violence. But two, it's coming from the perspective of those organisations. So it's not, you know, how do we address the well-being of this workforce necessarily, although that might be an outcome of this training. It's about, like, how do we do violence prevention in the community and intervention. So you can see those are really good programs, but what we actually need is something on the hair and beauty industry side that is responding to this issue.
Can we talk about the gendered side of things? So most, I think, most people who work in this industry, I'm pretty sure it skews female. We're talking a lot about hairdressers. That there's sort of an assumption in this conversation. We're talking a lot about women. Men get their hair done too. What do we know about what it's like in a barber's shop? Is the same sort of stuff happening there?
Yeah, so the stats in Australia is that 76% of the hairdressing workforce is women and 98% of beauty therapy is women. So, yeah, a huge skew there. You do tend to see more men at the higher levels of salon, like salon ownership. So there's this kind of interesting gender dynamic in terms of the socioeconomics of salons. In terms of barbershops, so my research has really been focused on salons and the kind of feminized feminine space. But there is work from the USA, funnily enough, by this woman, Kristen Barber. So you can easily remember her name to look up. And, you know, she found that, you know, you do see these kind of dynamics of sharing going on in those spaces, but barbershops are also very masculine spaces where there's other norms about reinforcing and maintaining masculinity, which isn't always about disclosure. And sometimes that is, you know, I mean, I talked to my partner about this. He's like, I go to the barbershop and they talk to me about sports. And I go to the hair salon and, you know, we talk about what's going on in my life. So it's not that people aren't disclosing to barbers, because I've absolutely heard from barbers who've later worked in hair salons, and I interviewed them, that it happens in barbershops as well. But yes, I do think that the caring question, the intensity of what's going on in hair and beauty salons that are dominated by a women's workforce, this is like where the real issue is in terms of what's not being addressed. So I guess the ideal world would be that you introduce a wellbeing unit that's absolutely across like hair and barbering units and a core one for beauty services. And then more research in Australian context about the gender dynamics that are happening in barbershops.
So Stacey, if you'd had the kind of training that you're recommending now from this work that you've done, would you have stayed in hairdressing longer, do you think?
I definitely would have if I had had the tools to sort of cope with that interaction and have understood the way that, you know, conversations worked. I would have stayed. I mean, obviously, it's the lowest paid trade as well, so that's always a factor. But it's the reason I sought out studying psychology was because I was, you know, I like to help people. I like to know about their lives, but I didn't know how to cope with that way of doing it. You know, conversation. I needed to have that training to be able to continue in that industry without burning out.
I'm really enjoying reading your texts this morning. Tracy says, I did beauty therapy for a while and can definitely attest to the fact that when you start to touch a person, the floodgates open. I think it's because we live in such a touch-deprived society. I described my work back then as a psychologist / beauty therapist. It was very draining and led me to give up. And Kelly says, shout out to Darren Jones in Canberra, who has been doing my hair for about 30 years. We have a lot of laughs together. I love going in for a coffee and a laugh and a haircut. They say this. Kelly continues to say this is a psychosocial safety issue. I'm also a former hairdresser, and exactly as your guest has said, there's an understanding that you have to touch someone to do their job. With that seems to be an opening up of their thoughts and feelings. We had no training on this, but I once worked in a business where a glass of wine together at the end of the day was often a common occurrence. Hannah, not going to diss a glass of wine with the colleagues at the end of the day, but doesn't sound like the healthiest way to debrief.
Absolutely.
What kind of workplace safety should we be seeing?
Yeah, so I think that without kind of introducing these norms within salons about debriefing and about, you know, being really open about the kind of care and emotional labor that's going on, what you see sometimes is like party cultures, people just kind of not talking openly about these things with each other in the workplace, but like partying it away and or drinking it away. That's definitely a dynamic. And that's not going to be sustainable for people in the long run. So yes, thinking about this as psychosocial hazard, I really want to pick up on, you know, the touching aspect is really key here, and this can be really meaningful to people in this touch-starved world, and particularly elderly people. A lot of the research from around the world suggests that sometimes hair and beauty workers are the only people really that are having physical contact with some of our elderly population. But at the same time, that aspect, as Stacey said right at the beginning, can be abused by people. And I was quite surprised about the number of stories I heard about sexual harassment and assault happening in salons. And that seems to be, there's total silence on that. Like I've never really heard that being talked about openly. So I think that there's a lot of safety issues going on here, like mental well-being, physical well-being, safety, consent, what to do, where to go, where to get help yourself. The other thing to say, salon workers have their own experiences, and they can be triggered by things that that clients say to them. So this is another aspect of how do I look after my well-being when someone's telling me these things.
Go gently into the salon and take care of each other as you're there. Hannah, Stacey, thank you both so much for joining me. Dr. Hannah McCann is a senior lecturer in cultural studies at the University of Melbourne. Stacey Page is a former hairdresser and current PhD student at Adelaide University. Together, Stacey and Hannah co-authored this study into the impact of emotional labour on salon workers. Thanks for your texts. Alex says, I was a massage practitioner for 25 years. I needed to do a counselling course to cope with people's stories. Another says, I think for women it's something ancient. The grooming and care of hair maintenance is so cultural and deeply intimate. Imagine the people who would be related or care enough initially to do your hair. Mothers, sisters, close friends, but also simply people are awkward and the need to fill the silence. Once that tap is turned on, it's hard to turn off. I couldn't have put it better myself. Well, coming up next, what is the best way to quit your job?
How can we believe what we see?
Discover a vault filled with secrets on ABC iView.
I don't know what I'm going to find here.
Mysteries to unravel.
Yeah, I heard that.
Are you sure you're up for this?
Clues to untangle.
It's dangerous. Someone always gets hurt.
All the cases, all the crime.
Nobody wants to believe that their friends are capable of murder.
Shetland, The Capture, Bergerac, Treasure and Dirt, and so many more.
You can't say I didn't warn you.
Delve deep on ABC iView.
On average, you will spend around 90,000 hours of your life at work. And you might be thinking, great, I love it here. But that is a long time to spend somewhere if you're not happy. So if you don't like your job, is the answer to just quit? Is the grass really greener on the other side? And is there a good way to quit? I'm about to get into some do's and don'ts, but I do want to hear from you. If you've ever quit a job, what happened next? Do you have any advice on how to do it well in retrospect? Or if you're thinking of quitting your job and you have a question for my guest, text me, because I am here with Lisa Leong, host of This Working Life on ABC Radio National, our go-to expert for all things work. Hey, Lisa.
I quit.
Can you quit in like 10 minutes once we've finished having our chat?
Okay. You've got 10 minutes.
Have you ever like spectacularly quit a job?
I'm like the opposite. Actually. So, I mean, not even the quiet quitting, but I'm a boomerang. So that's a term for someone who quits a job but keeps on going back. So I think this is my second time at the ABC. I've gone to a former corporate job. I think it's three times. So you just can't get rid of me, Tegan. So, you know, in a way.
We wouldn't want to.
Yeah, exactly. More like a leave of absence, maybe.
Fair, fair. Well, it's the sort of thing that, I mean, when you have a bad day, maybe you fantasize about it a bit. I don't. Obviously, I have the best job in the world, but other people do. Mm. What are some of the drivers for people when they're feeling dissatisfied in their work?
It's really interesting. There's some recent research, but it goes back a long way. But the research confirms that actually it's less about you and more about these events that actually cause a lot of resignations, a lot of quitting. So this is when the person decides to quit. And so they've been labelled a great term. It's called a jolt. a jolt, J-O-L-T. So they can be small or big. They can actually be in your work or they can be in your personal life. And they fall into different categories. And I guess it's looking at these categories. So, for example, there might be a direct jolt. It might be bad feedback from a manager who makes you think, oh, I'm just not valued here at work. So that's a pretty obvious one. There's a really fantastic category, though, called the collateral jolt. So, Tegan, if you notice that there's restructures going on and all of your mates are leaving work, then often that can cause you to question, why am I here? Am I going to be the only one here? So that's called a collateral jolt. And in fact, I heard this story of someone who goes to this conference and basically he gets told every single sort of half an hour about somebody else planning to leave his team. And he gets so sad that he decides, actually, you know, next time I get asked for an interview, I might just take it. Turns out, he takes the interview, he does really well, he leaves, but he's the only one who ends up leaving. So that's a collateral jolt gone really wrong, isn't it?
So this is what you were talking about this week on This Working Life on ABC Radio National. Find it on the ABC Listen. One of the people you spoke to was Anthony C. Klotz. He's the guy who coined the term the Great Resignation.
I love this. So he is a champion.
Are people still greatly resigning like they were when he coined that term?
Really interesting. So he actually accidentally coined this phrase for a start. So he was talking to a journalist and he sort of said, look, it's like the Great Resignation. And obviously it turned into a big thing. Even we covered it as well. So he didn't want to try and coin a new phrase, but he did use the phrase job hugging, Tegan. So that is the phrase for what's going on now. So the trend is people are still thinking about quitting, but because of the environment, it's just a little bit more uncertain, right? So people are instead job hugging. They don't really want to quit yet, but it's not ideal because it's not like engagement is up. So people are not resigning in masses, but we do have this feeling of malcontent, this feeling of, oh, I actually don't want to be here, but I have to be here. So it's not the greatest trend at the moment. And so I guess we're sort of going deeper on, okay, so when does a jolt become something where it's actually so big that you want to just leave?
Lisa, you were asking for listeners' stories about quitting. I just want to play one from your show.
I recently quit a job after 5 years with a significant amount of travel and stress, probably a bit of burnout, but, you know, definitely some issues. I quit because I thought I needed to not have a senior job and also be looking outside. So I quit with a view to taking some time off and finding a role, but that has proven to be very, very difficult as a woman in my 50s. And I've actually probably applied for about 100 jobs and not successful at all.
So that was Danielle's story she shared with you, which is pretty scary. She's obviously taken this big leap and it hasn't paid off for her yet.
Yeah. And there are sort of two parts to this story, Tegan. The first part is when you're so burnt out that you feel like you have to leave, but you're spent. So there's nothing left for the very big job, really, of thinking about what do I want to do next and doing all of those things like the applications. You actually need to be in a creative mode, not a burnt out mode. So trying to pick it a bit early. Unfortunately, the thing with burnout is sometimes you're the last to know. Mm-hmm. And you talked about being stuck. So that feeling of being stuck and then letting it every day go on until actually it's a little bit too late. So then there's an approach that Anthony Klotz does talk about, which is this idea of trying not that she rage quit at all, but trying to carry on enough and then actually respond by trying to speak up. I know that's really hard and you've got to kind of do it gently because some managers might not want to hear it. And then the lean back. So this is this antidote to the burnout, which is, it's not quite quitting, but it's similar. It's that, do you take your foot off the pedal enough so that you can actually, first of all, try and heal in terms of the burnout or the exhaustion, and then also think about the next step. So, in fact, when I was a lawyer, I noticed that I was putting an extra 10% in doing extra things for my law firm in London. So I was doing all the emceeing of Christmas parties. I took the 10% and then I used that to donate my time to community events to figure out what would actually excite me. And that's when I started volunteering in hospital radio. That's when I started doing radio, Tegan. So with that 10%, and then that sort of helped me quit, I guess, the law firm and the law at that stage. So it's that sort of, can you find that 10% to then go and invest that in your future?
I love this. Is Lisa Leong's broadcasting origin story coming to light here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, talking to Lisa about quitting well, if you can. I'd love to hear your stories. One says, I quit my job recently in my mid-50s, would definitely advise to leave the workplace on good terms with a very pleasant resignation email, even if it's difficult to write, as it can make the last few weeks smoother and also help with looking for work. Yeah, Lisa, give us some practical tips that you've learned through this this investigation on how to do it, how to know when, and how to do it well.
Definitely there are different ways to quit. We talked about the rage quitting. That's one way. And sometimes that happens because you feel powerless and therefore, you know, that's your time, I guess, to feel like you want to speak up and you've had enough. It's the straw that broke the camel's back. That is a category. It's not seen as being the most useful because, you know, as you know, the world is small and you still want a future job. And I think when you leave very abruptly, it does leave all of that behind you and people then have to sort of clean up a little bit after you. Then the extreme is, you know, telling people really early and getting them proactively involved, I guess, in the quitting. But some people are just not in that place to do that. So it is a spectrum. In between that is doing what you need to do kind of under your contract. So making sure that you give, if it's 4 weeks notice, it's 4 weeks notice. Trying not to do it by email, just like super abruptly. But if you need to, then, you know, that's the option for you. So that's sort of the clean cut, I guess, category in the middle. And it's working out, I guess. I think it's something to do with values as well. So how I leave is how I wish to live. So how I leave is how I wish to live. And so, you know, it's about being consistent and, you know, if you want to leave in a good way, then you want to live in a good way. So that's kind of my take on this.
And one of the questions that Anthony recommended is if you're not sure where your heart lies is the lottery question.
Okay, so the lottery question, it's actually been asked since the 1970s. The question is, if you won all the money in the world, you never actually had to work again, would you quit your job? That is the lottery question. Now, most people actually say, no, I would not quit. I would not quit work. Sorry, I would not quit work. But then his little change to this, a little riff was, would you quit your current job? And actually only 10% of people would stay in their current job. So there's quite a gap there.
Lisa Leong, thank you, as always, for joining me. Lisa hosts This Working Life here on ABC Radio National. You can find all of This Working Life episodes on ABC Listen, including a Try This companion episode all about how to quit. And thank you for your texts. One person says, I quit a toxic and sexist workplace. The big boss was yelling at me. I can't even remember why. When the penny dropped, I didn't need to be there. I didn't need to allow that jerk to abuse me. So as he was still yelling, I walked to my desk, typed a resignation letter, walked to the printer, printed it out, signed the letter, and handed it to him. Most satisfying quitting ever. Earlier, you learned about the sleep paradox and why even though us humans feel like we're always sleeping poorly, sleeping fewer hours every night is a kind of evolutionary superpower. Evolutionary biologist David Sampson was speaking to me earlier. He's the author of The Sleepless Ape, The Story of Sleep in Human Evolution. This is him explaining the difference between optimal sleep and paleo sleep.
I made a deal with my wife. I was like, Nancy, can I take 3 months? I know you're pregnant right now. Can I take 3 months and basically turn on the optimal sleep gear? Meaning I'm going to be waking up exactly the same time every day. I'm going to have a Benedictine monk like religious schedule to my day. But what that will do is it will allow me to predictably unleash the best versions of my cognition at my sweet spot for writing. And what I predict is that I'll be able to write this book way faster so that when our firstborn is born, I will be able to turn on the paleo gear, meaning you can lean into all the other things that are more important than getting sleep that night.
Well, you have been listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. That is just about all the time we have together today. I will be back with you again tomorrow. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.